The commentary on this podcast is not intended to serve as or replace professional, legal, financial, or medical advice. While the insights may have wide applicability, listeners should consult with a licensed or certified professional in your state to obtain advice with respect to your particular case.
Is it mine or is it theirs? What do you mean I only have an interest in it? I paid towards it. I lived in it. Or, on the flip side, how does he have an interest in it? I'm the one that made every single payment. I bought all of it. Or, what if it was, what? I do have a financial interest in it? That's not what he's been telling me. Dividing assets is a fundamental part of the dissolution of your marriage. And leaving money on the table, or giving too much of it away, tends to lead to nothing but contention and bitterness for years to come, especially if you find out after your divorce is finalized that you didn't have all of the factual information and you made some decisions that worked against your best interest, and now you can't change them. This is Divorced and Determined AF, the show that supports women with the information you need to know before, during, and beyond divorce. My name is Jamie Milam, and I am determined to empower you to make informed decisions and take aligned action so that you can live the life you deserve. And trying to figure out what you're entitled to when it comes to some of your largest assets is a huge part of the divorce process, and it can often be one of the biggest obstacles in coming to an agreement. But many women's financial future hangs on this major element. There are many nuances to what is considered marital versus non-marital or separate property and how, if at all, it's divided between you and your spouse. So what exactly is marital interest? How is it created? What's considered marital property and separate property by nature? And can separate property, such as a house that was purchased by one party prior to the marriage, become a marital asset and be considered property that now needs to be equitably distributed? Well, here to help us set the facts straight to these exact questions is North Carolina divorce attorney Teresa Vera. Growing up, Teresa experienced firsthand the abuse and financial manipulation her mother endured. Through the years of domestic violence and even beyond the divorce, she witnessed her father take every effort to maintain power and control over her mother, including cutting her financial means off. Her traumatic childhood is the reason she became a family law attorney. And as a certified family financial mediator, and even as a litigator, she has seen all too often how many times someone was about to leave something on the table, and she truly understands the long-term effects this can have on a family. Just as the assertive yet endearing voice of a family law attorney inspired confidence in her mother all those years ago, Teresa hopes to do the same today. And in case your head starts swirling with all of the information that we have in today's episode, and you need to see it broken down for you, well, stay tuned to the end and I'll let you know where you can find just that. So, let's dive in. Divorce is an overwhelming process that most of us did not know how to navigate until we were in the thick of it, which can cost us a lot more time, money, and energy than necessary. Divorced and Determined AF hopes to change that. I'm your host, Jamie Milam. I'm a realtor and a certified divorce specialist who not only works with divorcing couples when selling their home, but I am also divorced, and I know firsthand how much having thorough resources would positively impact women for years to come. I'm bringing together fellow divorcees and experts working in the field to talk about this private taboo topic, all with the goal to help you feel prepared, educated, assured, confident, and empowered to make informed decisions related to your divorce journey. So whether you're just now considering a divorce, in the midst of it, or are now navigating a new norm and are determined AF to do it your way, this is your safe space. You deserve it. Welcome back, Teresa. I'm so glad that you're here because this is a topic that just keeps coming up in these groups that I'm in with these women going through a divorce. So I really feel like we need to dig into the weeds of property and not necessarily like just selling your house and splitting assets, but more so what is community property, what is separate property, or simply marital, non-marital. So I know that we want to likely remind our listeners that there's two different ways that states consider property division, and that's equitable distribution and community property. And I know that here in the Carolinas, we are equitable distribution states, and I believe there's only like 9 community property states. Is that right?
I honestly am not positive, just because I'm only licensed here in North Carolina. But yeah, there are certain community property states and equitable distribution states. I tend to encourage people not to get too confused or boggled in the weeds of the differences, because at the end of the day, what a court is going to look at is what is supposed to be divided between the spouses, soon to be ex-spouses, versus what is considered, to your point, separate property. That's generally where the biggest kind of going back and forth occurs. I will note, though, in community property jurisdictions, there is basically a premise that marital property will be divided 50-50 or as close to equal as possible, whereas equitable distribution states are more about, well, what's equitable? And equitable, yes, in North Carolina, we have a 50-50 presumption, but that does not mean that's actually going to be what a judge orders should a property division go to court.
Okay. So that was going to be another one of my questions, is that it's a common perception that North Carolina is 50-50, even though we're an equitable distribution state, but that's not necessarily like a this is for sure thing.
Correct. In fact, I think that's one of the most widely held misconceptions when it comes to property distributions as a result of divorce in North Carolina. Now, if you consult with an attorney because you're going through the divorce process, that attorney will likely say, okay, well, the courts will divide it 50-50. Let's start negotiating from that standpoint, which is a very good position to start from. However, I have been in enough trials to see that when a case actually ends up in a courtroom, it may not be 50-50. And so there are a whole list of factors listed in the North Carolina General Statute, which I presume is relatively similar to other states that are equitable distribution. And that's a pretty extensive list of what a court can consider to determine what is equitable. I'll give an example, because it's an example that does tend to come up often, and that is the retirement ability. So for example, let's say a couple has been married 20 years, one spouse has earned substantially more than the other spouse, and as a result has been able to simply save more money in a retirement account as a result. Yes, the presumption is like that retirement account will be split 50-50, but think long term. That lower income earner or possibly stay-at-home spouse does not have the job or the 401k or the financial ability to continue to contribute to a retirement account like the other spouse can. So a judge very well may say, well, let's go ahead and give that lower income earner slightly a greater percentage of the retirement accounts so that at the end of the day, both parties do have a good nest egg to retire on. And when I say that, though, it all comes back to arguments of both sides, looking at financial circumstance in totality, and then it comes to what the attorneys want to argue.
Mm-hmm. And the assets as a whole, the entire quote unquote portfolio, right?
Yep.
So when we're talking about equitable distribution, nonetheless, we are talking about property and assets. And that's going to be the marital property that they're going to be splitting up, correct?
Yes and no.
Right. I know. I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were.
Welcome to the quote, it depends argument. So yes, in the sense that it does come down to numbers, and those numbers are primarily attached to what is traditionally defined as marital property. So a good example is a couple gets married, they buy a house, the house is put into joint names. Okay, that is a house that is going to be considered marital property. Now, you can't take a chainsaw and just physically divide it in half, of course, right? So we're talking more about, well, what's the equity in it? If there's no mortgage, then what is the fair market value of it? And how do we split that considering the other assets? But the equitable distribution factors that come in are honestly other considerations. To your point, the remainder of the estate, of course, is factored in. But there's also other factors. So, for example, are there minor children? do we want to keep the minor children in that house until the youngest age is out of the child support guideline situation of 18 years old here in North Carolina, or maybe after they graduate from college? You know, there's a whole factor there. And then separate from that is, okay, is there a separate component or a marital component to separate property? And so those are all factors that come into the equation.
Yes, exactly. So when it comes to equitable distribution, you and I, we preach this nonstop to everybody. It's everybody's case is going to be different because there are so many different variables and factors. But you are leading right into where I kind of want to stick in with this is the separate and the marital property. Because to your example, a couple gets married, they purchase a home. This is going to be considered marital property because it was acquired after they got married.
Correct.
So is it possible for us to kind of maybe start at a very basic level? Are there things that are by nature considered separate property instead of marital property?
Generally, anything that was purchased prior to the date of marriage is separate property. Now, that can get a little tricky because if you purchase a car and let's say only one person put down the down payment or paid for the car in full, but still put the title of the car in joint names, even though it's prior to the date of marriage, that could be considered joint property, even if it's not technically marital property. Flip side of that, there are certain things, depending on, again, the circumstances of an individual case, there could be inheritances that are separate property. Now, the piece of an inheritance that is tricky is, well, when was the inheritance actually received? And then how was it received? Was it money? And that money was then put into a joint bank account between both spouses? Well, some courts may see that as you've just gifted that those monies that would have been considered separate property to the marriage, especially if from that bank account, daily expenses are paid for both spouses, such as utilities, the mortgage, car payments, groceries, and things like that.
Or if they got an inheritance and then they used it for even like a large purchase together.
Yeah. And the large purchase, you know, we do have, legally speaking, title documents, right? So when you buy a car, you get a title that has names listed. When you buy real property or a house, you have a deed that has names that are listed. If both spouses' names are listed on that title document, and yes, you may have used separate funds or inheritance funds to purchase that new house, well, you've just gifted certain separate funds to the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So generally speaking, separate property, think of all the property owned in full prior to the date of marriage. Marital property is between that date of marriage and that date of separation. And then date of separation to date of distribution, we have another form of property that we call divisible property here in North Carolina, because we only want to complicate it further.
Yeah, thank you, North Carolina. Because, you know, North Carolina, we just like to be funky and make it difficult for anybody to keep track of it, which is exactly why you need professional guidance. Okay, so is there any way that you can give us some clarity in terms of when you say marital property from the date of marriage to prior to the date of separation? Is that the date that all parties agree this is the day that we separated? No.
No.
Y'all don't see her. She's shaking her head.
No. Nope.
I'm like, all right, lay it down for us.
So the date of separation, as defined by the North Carolina Court of Appeals, is the date at which both parties reside under separate roofs, with one of them having the intent to end the relationship, the marital relationship. So say someone needs to go out of town for 3 months because they have a job in another state. That doesn't count. That's just, hey, I'm leaving and staying outside of the marital residence for employment purposes. However, if the parties do come to a situation where one party is like, I'm done with this relationship, I'm out, and they move into, say, an apartment, that date would be considered the date of separation. Now, in North Carolina, yeah, it can get a little gray because there are people that say they may live separately, but they still hold out that marital relationship. So if you're still going on dates, if you're still having sexual relationships, if you're still Mr. and Mrs. in the eyes of the community and your church, et cetera, then the argument can be made that the date of separation is not just tied to where you slept overnight. But if you have separated, i.e. under separate roofs, and you at least one of you has the intent to end the marital relationship, even if that intent is not conveyed to the opposing side, then the date as of that occurring could be considered your date of separation under North Carolina law. And I preface this, could be considered your date of separation. And again, that's why you want to consult with an attorney to make sure that's clearly defined.
Yeah. And definitely not to get hung up on this, but I definitely want to repeat here that it's under separate roofs, y'all. You can't come in and say, we've been living in separate rooms.
Bedrooms, and, yep. Yeah, I get that
and
all the time.
We don't want to be together anymore. We've not wanted to be together. We've been doing this for over a year now. No, it has to be in two separate locations and residences. But all right, so I do want to kind of figure out how separate property, and I know you've mentioned how inheritances can be gifted to the marriage and that then becomes property that is now marital and can be divided between the two. It's considered something for distribution. But I want to present a scenario to you because you kind of started with a car, and I'm just going to see if we can't maybe figure this one out.
Sure. I love these scenarios.
Well, and I see it a lot in my industry, right? So let's say that a couple buys a house while they are in a relationship. Let's say that they're engaged, because that does indicate an intention to be married. And one party purchases a home while they are engaged. For whatever reason, the other person is not on the mortgage. Maybe they couldn't qualify. And the title as well, because we do see this often, if first-time home buyers especially, they don't know that they could put the other person on the title too if they are on the mortgage. And if the lender isn't doing any asking, if they only see that the mortgage is one person, you ask if you're married, they say no, you know, then it very well could be by accident or intentionally that this property now goes in one person's name, both on the mortgage and on the title. Okay, so fast forward a few years, they get married, okay, and they don't make any changes to the title. They don't make any changes to the mortgage. It's not ever refinanced to include her. Wife pays the mortgage a few times out of her own account. Otherwise, let's assume that he's continued to pay the payments out of his account. Now, fast forward a few more years, and they're getting divorced. Husband says she has no rights to the house because he bought it prior to them getting married. You want to verbalize that?
So let's delve into there, right? Because this is obviously a hypothetical. I am going to start with, I have a lot of questions as an attorney. So for example, if they bought the house during the engagement period prior to the date of marriage, where did the down payment monies come from? Did they have a joint bank account? Did they have a separate bank account? Did the monies come from his separate bank account or her separate bank account? And I say his or her, and I should say spouse one and spouse two, right? Because we have same-sex couples. This sure applies across the board. And so because it was bought before the date of marriage, it cannot be considered marital property. No marital relationship exists. My next question is, was there a prenuptial agreement? Because a prenup, if the couple had discussed the prenup factors and entered into a prenuptial agreement, or premarital agreement is the legal term here in North Carolina, then that premarital agreement would govern what happens to that property. So for example, I have seen this, and therefore I have put into some premarital agreements that because this property was bought during the engagement and because it is intended to be the marital residence, once they get married, that said property shall be transferred into joint names within, say, 90 days of the date of the wedding, for example. And that's a pretty simple process from the legal side. Some other documents may need to be signed, but if there was a prenup and let's say it wasn't followed, that could protect that non-owning spouse's rights should a divorce occur down the line. So hands down, if anyone finds themselves in that situation, please do the prenuptial discussion at the very least. If not, please get a prenup. Now, if we move forward and we recognize that there's no prenup, and let's say in a husband-wife situation, husband is the one who purchased the house, husband is the one who got the mortgage, husband is the one who put the full down payment from, say, a separate bank account, they get married. Now, any funds earned by either spouse after that date of marriage is technically marital property because they don't have a prenup stating otherwise. So if, let's say he takes earnings after the date of marriage and pays on the mortgage, well, that reduction in the mortgage principal has now just created a marital interest in that house. Same with her. So if she has earned funds after the date of marriage and taken those funds and paid on the mortgage, I don't care when, I don't care how much it is. I just know that there may have been marital funds now paying toward husband's separate debt because that mortgage, again, was created by him prior to the date of marriage. So that could create a marital interest. And this is where it gets very tricky because technically, yes, the house is his separate property, but a marital interest has attached to it. Does that make sense? You're nodding, I think it does.
Yeah, it does to me. And I'm really interested because that's where I was wanting to go with that is when you have that marital interest in the property and you said you don't care how much either of them paid towards it, does that even get more elevated if now you've created a joint bank account, right? Mm-hmm. And he's putting all of his earnings, his employment earnings, post date of marriage into this joint account, even if he has separate accounts, if that's the main one.
Sure.
And they're making payments out of that joint account. Mm-hmm. Does that tell you as an attorney, okay, well, we've got marital interest in this because the payments are coming out of this joint account? Or is it only because—
That really doesn't matter. They could have completely separate bank accounts. It has to do with where did the money come from? So like, for example, if he had a savings account that he had when he was 10 years old and it just happened to have $100,000 in it, and he was using that account to pay the mortgage payments on his separate property, then technically he's using separate funds to pay for a separate debt. No marital component exists. However, if he earns money during the marriage and he then from his separate bank account that maybe he even had prior to the date of marriage, but those earnings themselves are used to pay on the mortgage, that's what creates the marital interest.
Now, even if she's never made a payment towards it?
Correct. Unless they have a prenup stating otherwise.
Fascinating. So you've got even a stay-at-home mom who has no earnings and he's making payments on a home, then she has marital interest in it.
There's possibly a marital interest. I would say possibly because this obviously is for education purposes only, and there's so many other factors that can influence this. But generally speaking, yes, if they're, again, absent a prenup, if there are monies earned after the date of marriage by either spouse, regardless of where the monies go, and that goes toward either person's separate debt, whether it's a mortgage or a car loan or anything really, then you're creating a marital interest in said item. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean she technically has the right to put possession of the house or to sell the house or anything like that, because it is, quote unquote, his separate property if it was never transferred into joint name. But it could very well still mean she has some type of financial interest in it. Now, let me also point out, when you pay down a mortgage, that's what we call an active increase to the equity of the house or the item that you're paying down the loan on. And what I mean by active is there was a debt and that debt is now lower, therefore increasing the equity, and those payments are active, right? Like you're physically doing something and you're influencing how much you pay. For example, some people pay more than their minimum mortgage payment. Therefore, that principal reduction is going to reduce even further. On the flip side, you have passive increase, especially to real property, as you know. And that passive increase, if it's passive increase to separate property, then that is likely, generally speaking, not going to be considered marital interest. So house goes from a value of $200,000 to $400,000 just because of market forces. Unfortunately, unless the wife in this scenario has her name on that deed or it was otherwise refinanced or there was another deed issued into joint names after the date of marriage, she loses out on some of that equity build because of the market forces.
Because the market value has to be influenced by something that you are actively doing to change that value, which could be
correct.
Said the same for a business or something of that sort. So let me simplify this for the listeners, real life scenario. So let's say your spouse had purchased the home before the marriage at $300,000. By the time you're getting ready to be divorced, you now owe $200,000. Mm-hmm. So does she have marital interest potentially in that $100,000 worth of active equity, or is it what the balance was at the time of marriage?
So it is the balance at the time of marriage.
Got
it. Principal balance. So to take your same example, let's say house value at date of purchase by husband was $300,000, but he put $50,000 down and then he paid it down a little by the date of marriage. So as of the date of marriage, the mortgage principal is $240,000. And let's say at the date of separation, the mortgage principal balance is $200,000. Then you're looking at a marital interest possibly of $40,000.
Even if now, the house is now worth $450,000,
correct.
You don't get that equity between the amount that it was purchased for to what today's value is.
Correct.
So it's that $40,000.
Correct. And that can trip up a lot of people. Now, go one step further. Paying down the mortgage is just one example where you can increase the equity of a house with active means, right? With actively making payments. You could also increase the value of the house, say, by renovations, adding a pool, adding a two-story deck, adding a whole floor, adding a garage. There are so many things you can do to a house to increase the equity. Now, what does that mean?
After the date of marriage.
After the date of marriage. What does that mean, though? That means that you have to look at the fair market value increase of the improvement, not the amount you spent on that improvement. You probably know better than me that just because you renovate the kitchen doesn't mean you're going to get a dollar-for-dollar return.
That's right. You guys drop $100K on a pool today. You are not getting that back when you go to sell it. Not
exactly.
At all. You're going to get a sticker shock for what I'm going to tell you that the market's going to bring for that pool.
And that's the marital interest for purposes of division. So let's say you do spend $100,000 in a pool, but it only increases the fair market value of $10,000. And we're looking at a $10,000 number, not a $100,000 number.
Right. All right. Okay. You keep saying possibly.
Yep.
Obviously, there's a lot of factors in play.
Yep.
Are there any of them that we haven't mentioned?
Not exactly. Because again, as you pointed out earlier, these cases are so unique to the couple and the individual because no two couples have the same marital state, same financial circumstance, or same financial need, really. So, you know, there's so many different factors that influence the equitable determination for property division.
But it's more so what you may have marital interest in.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned divisible property. Is there an easy way to tell us what that is?
Sure. So divisible property, generally speaking, is think about the assets and debts that were created or obtained during the marriage, but still you have to maintain them between the date of separation and the date all of this stuff is resolved. So for example, after the date of separation, I hope the mortgage is still getting paid.
Me too.
So let's start this example, though, that the house was purchased during the marriage and the mortgage is in joint names, meaning it's a joint asset and a joint debt. Well, let's say spouse one, after the date of separation, is the one that stays in the house, earns money after the date of separation, and with those funds, pays on the mortgage. Well, they have technically just taken their separate property and paid on a marital debt for the benefit of a marital asset. So the divisible factors come into play where it's like, okay, what are we going to look at in terms of, okay, that increase in equity due to the mortgage principal pay down? Is that a portion of divisible property or are there other factors that influence that?
But For a lot of people who separate on April 1st, they go their 12 months separated and they don't file anything. But somebody's moved out because they have to establish an official date of separation. And
yeah.
So whoever is paying on that mortgage with their income over that year, that technically becomes divisible property in North Carolina.
Again, it depends because, for example, let's say those payments came from a marital savings account. Then we're talking marital
funds paying on a marital debt.
Related to a marital asset, right? There could also be certain things that are increased or decreased due to no efforts by the spouses, which is really where the divisible factor comes in. So, for example, passive increase in that same house. So let's say at the date of separation, the house was worth $400,000. But as of the date of distribution, because it's taken 2 years to litigate the equitable distribution matter, it's increased to $500,000. That $100,000 may be considered divisible property because it wasn't due to the efforts of either spouse. And again, it all depends because there could be so here's another example. Someone earns a bonus, but they receive the money after the date of separation. So let's say annual bonuses for a certain company are issued April 15th of the following year. Well, the parties separated on January 1st, 2024, but spouse one got their bonus for 2023 on April 15th, 2024.
That's marital income.
We would argue that that's marital income, right? But let's say that those funds are then used to pay the mortgage. Okay, well, then it goes to a marital debt related to a marital asset. So
are you ladies picking up on why it's so important to actually bring your specific case instead of just relying on these Facebook groups? And I love the Facebook groups for the simple fact of being able to encourage you to keep going, to remind you of what you are worth, and to remind you to investigate these things. But if there's anything that Teresa has said over and over is, it depends, right?
Yeah.
But it sounds like there's a lot of options here for a potential for still having marital interest in something that somebody's telling you that you don't have any interest in and you have zero rights to. And that's not fair to listen to until you get to go and speak with an attorney and find out what you're truly entitled to.
Yeah. Unless the person telling you those comments is a family law attorney that has dealt with equitable distribution cases or community property, depending on your jurisdiction, don't listen to them.
Yeah. I mean, and even one who has dealt with that, but hasn't looked at your particular case and your finances and your account, because it sounds like, I mean, we're spelling out scenarios, but it still is, it's a possibility. We need to see all the other things and elements to that. I'm going to ask a really funky question that may or may not be relevant to it. I think it is. What about the furniture purchased during their marriage? I do hear often, I experienced it myself. You know, if one spouse doesn't want the furniture, they're moving out, they want to start fresh, they don't want to take this with them, they're going to leave it behind. Is that something that is divisible? Like, do they have a right to the financial value of that furniture if it was purchased with marital funds?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's the easiest thing I can say there. If it's marital property, it's subject to distribution, meaning, and the statute says it very clear here in North Carolina, is anything that's subject to distribution, a judge must classify as to whether it's marital or divisible or separate property, one. Two, the value related to it, if it's marital or divisible, and then who gets it? And let's say, to your point, one of the spouses moves out, the other spouse is kind of stuck with all the furniture. They will have the value of that furniture in their column when it comes to the division of the marital estate. Now, I will say this. If you paid for a couch and you paid $10,000, I promise you it's not $10,000 in your column for that couch. We're talking yard sale, garage sale prices, which is the fair market value. And I don't know if anyone has been on, I guess everyone sells things on Facebook Marketplace nowadays. If you go on there, you are not getting close to store purchase prices on a Facebook Marketplace. You're just not.
No way.
So
no way.
That's personally, I tend to tell my clients, you know, let's not get too boggled down with the personal property items in the house, such as furniture, such as dishes, such as towels. Now, that's a little bit differentiated from,
like, collectibles, high value jewelry or art.
Exactly. So the high value stuff, yes, but even then, you're still looking at the fair market value. So, you know, if you have a Monet, yes, we're definitely including that. If you happen to just have an art piece from a local artist that you happen to purchase for $4,000, well, will someone else pay $2,000 for it? Can you find a buyer? It's very possible you might not be able to. And if so, if you cannot actually sell something on the fair market, then we have a problem determining the fair market value. It's been often where clients will come in and say, well, I spent you know, thousands of dollars on that piece of art or on that jewelry or on that collectible. But if there are no buyers out there, you're talking, okay, what would a pawn shop pay for it?
Mm-hmm. It's almost like real estate, you know, like it's that specific lot, it's that specific home on that location. But for them, it might be, I loved that vase and mm-hmm. nobody else wants that vase. They think it's ugly as heck, you know, so they're not going to pay that no matter how much you paid for it. Now, I want to say this really fast. Again, I'm going to be very specific that Teresa is licensed in North Carolina. We are talking about North Carolina law when it comes to divisible and such. These laws will be different in different states. And my own divorce was in South Carolina. I did see a mediator that was not an attorney. Mm-hmm. And we very specifically brought this question to them. Let me rephrase that. He very specifically brought the question to the mediator, but I had furnished the entire house and he mm-hmm. had made a list of how much he thought that furniture was purchased for. He was grossly mistaken. However, he didn't want any of it. And he asked the mediator, well, I don't want any of it. So will she pay me for half of it? And the mediator, again, not a licensed attorney, told us, no, if you're going to forfeit the furniture, then you don't get any financial value out of that. Now, again, I know you can't speak to South Carolina, and I don't know if it is any different in South Carolina or not, but pretending that we were in North Carolina, and this is what somebody had said to us that is not a licensed attorney, can you imagine how pissed my ex would be hearing this right now to learn that he missed out on half the value of furniture that I purchased in this home? Again, for today's value, nobody's going to be buying the couch that has all the cat scratches on it. I get why he didn't want to take it, but nonetheless, there's other nice furniture. So mm-hmm. it is fascinating. And this is also another reason why, yes, there are some quote unquote more affordable ways to handle your divorce, but they are not always going to be the most guiding if you don't take that to an attorney to interpret it for you to say, was there anything else you were hoping to get out of this? You know, to take that question to them and say, yeah, I mean, we have a whole house full of furniture. Like, am I not getting anything from that? Like, now I have to go furnish this whole other place. And there's expenses to that because we do have to live separate. So if anybody has caught on to anything today, I really genuinely hope that it's, one, everything is going to be different for your case. And two, please protect yourselves. You know, like, please, if you're buying property, please, before you get married, there are agreements that you can put into place, even if it's not a prenuptial or premarital agreement, because maybe you're not even having conversations yet of marriage. But there are still agreements that you can put in place if you are making a big joint purchase. And if purchases were made prior to your marriage and it's the full intent for you guys to be together, why would they not want to join and put you on the title for those things? And again, if they have concern, well, I've owned this house for 5-10 years, why should you have full access to whatever it's worth when and if we were to divorce? Well, you can still get a prenuptial or a postnuptial agreement that mm-hmm. outlines the division of the property asset there. And so, and you know what? And if you did that, and by the time you got divorced, you wanted to do something different, you could argue that if you both agreed. And if you don't agree, then you have an agreement in place already that protected you in the first place if you cannot come to a new agreement. So
yep.
protect yourself, and get the information that you need from a qualified professional.
Yep.
I'm so glad that you're here. I love how many times you're like, it depends, because in my line of work too, people will ask me questions. I'm like, listen, like, this is not a black and white industry. There are so many different factors. Your situation is different. Your house is different. It's the same with your divorce. So it really does depend. We have to look at the holistic picture. So I always appreciate you bringing that perspective to the table as a great reminder for our listeners. So thank you so much for being here.
Of course, of course. And I guess my last little tidbit is, I will say, in all the cases that I've seen, whether I've represented someone or not, or it's just something I've seen in a courtroom or come across my desk as an example or scenario, is that when parties do not consult with attorneys, they always leave something on the table. And my concern is if you're leaving a marital relationship and you've left more than, say, my consult fee on the table, and you've lost out much more than that, then it's too expensive not to consult with an attorney.
So true. It's so true. Thank you again.
Girl, is your head swirling? I mean, that was a lot of info packed into those 30 minutes. But let me give you a quick reminder here to always check your local state law, because what we discussed today is based on North Carolina law. But the kicker in all of this is that marital interest can be created in what is separate property if marital income is used to increase that value of separate property, such as paying down a mortgage or making improvements to the home. So if you're commingling separate and marital property, you may likely be creating a marital interest. So just because your spouse owned the house before you got married doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have a marital financial interest in the equity of that home. And the same can be said for retirement, even in several other assets. So I think a lot of women are likely leaving a lot of money on the table, or at the very least, some bargaining power, if they don't have the correct knowledge here. There are clearly a lot of nuances to this, which is why it's so critical and valuable to at least consult with an attorney to make sure that you have the facts to your case. Now, I'm going to be linking Teresa's contact information and her YouTube channel down in the show notes if you're in the need for an attorney in North Carolina. And if you're still digesting the differences in property types and you would find it helpful to have some bullet-pointed questions for you to maybe fill out and take to your legal consult to get the guidance that you need, well, then I'm glad that you stuck around, because we have that very handout for you over in the Peace of Mind Initiatives Resource Library. It's free and the resources just keep growing. So head over to peaceofminddivorce.info and sign up today. And of course, until next week, my friend, I wish you an abundance of peace and determination.